You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
This is Angela Fraley interviewing Betty Tompkins for Yale Radio. Thank you for being with us today.
It's my pleasure.
You just pulled out a magazine that you happen to be.
Yes, it's the annual edition of New York Magazine. And for the 10 best art shows of the year by Jerry Saltz, I am number 6.
Hooray.
And it says, Betty Tompkins at Bruce High Quality Foundation University Gallery, also known as FUG. Thank God a younger generation of artists is rediscovering the incredibly excellent Betty Tompkins, who in the 1960s, at the exact moment Chuck Close was commencing his giant face paintings, was making huge photorealist close-up depictions ripped straight out of straight male porn magazines. I like Tompkins way more than Close, and not just for the porn, but for how she reveals the secret lives of women's tremendously intense vision.
Huh.
And there's a nice photo of an ersatz kiss piece that I had in the FUG show.
Awesome.
Yeah.
That's
I mean,
so
this
great.
This is really great.
That's so great.
Chuck Close actually used to live in this building.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. He was on the top floor.
Uh-huh.
And people who would come to visit me when I was doing the early FUG paintings and Calcon paintings, they would come up here and they would look at my work, and almost every one of them would say to me, oh, just like Chuck Close, but lower down. It drove me nuts. And it was one of the reasons I stopped doing them. I didn't think I could stand to hear it one
more time.
Because it was so literally true.
Wow. That's
and they
amazing.
Didn't know.
Uh-huh.
It was the other thing.
How irritating that was.
Yeah. Well, they didn't know how literal
right.
it was.
You, right.
I'm
oh,
on the third floor. You was on the seventh floor.
Oh, that's so funny. So were you friends?
Oh, yeah. Very
yeah,
friendly.
Okay.
We're
okay.
a co-op. Everybody got along.
Gotcha. And this was in your older apartment, or is it?
No, that was in this
building.
Building.
Okay, great. So let's talk a little bit. I mean, what I normally like to ask is about the early years, you know, like what it was like beginning, like your path into the art world. But I feel like that's been talked about quite a bit in a lot of your other interviews. I'm kind of curious about this latest resurgence.
It's been amazing.
Yeah. Can you talk about
yes.
how that kind of came about? What were you doing in between?
I did a
you know,
lot of different kind of work. Right after the FUG paintings and the Calcon paintings, I did for many years, almost a decade, I did work that involved language, defining nouns. I started it during this period where reading art criticism had gotten suddenly incredibly onerous. It was very conceptual art oriented. Everything was multisyllabic words. It was the beginning of the period, to me, it was the beginning of period of art talk.
Mm-hmm.
I got so tired of throwing my magazines across the room in frustration, which is what I would do. I was just go, oh, fuck, shit. And I would just hurl the magazine across the room. But I started to think about, because a common phrase used in these articles was that the critic read the piece this way, or the critic read it this way. Nobody was looking, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
You were just reading. Mm-hmm. And in fact, when you went to the galleries, you were, in fact, reading.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, well, that's an interesting idea. Let's do something that can be read.
Mm-hmm.
So I had been doing Calcon paintings. There's one over there.
Uh-huh.
And I had all these photographs of cows. And when you look at a cow, it's actually a rectangle with some things sticking out
mm-hmm.
of it. The head, the tail, the legs, the udders, whatever.
Uh-huh.
So things sticking out. So I would draw a rectangle on a page, and I would draw a tenth of an inch grid. And within each grid, each square, I would write cow, cow, cow. Cow or bull or calf or whatever the animal was. It was very important to me that it be a defining noun,
mm-hmm.
and it was very important that it be the only mark on the page. So the volume or the illusion of volume was just from the lightness or darkness within the stroke of the letter.
Okay.
And you have to realize that my handwriting since the age of 13 has been basically illegible. And being in my 30s, it did not improve. It got, as a handwriting does, it just sort of disintegrates right. into whatever it's going to become. And people would look at anything I had written by hand, and then they would look at these pieces, mm-hmm. and they would say, how can this be the same person? And I would say, because this is a drawn mark, and this is writing. And I'm not writing, and I'm drawing. Mm-hmm. I'm just doing it. So eventually, I did watercolors with half-inch words, and I did paintings with one-inch words. And I was friends with Nick Krusnik, and he had cataracts at the time that I met him. And I was showing him these, and he said, tell you the truth, Betty, I can't read them. Mm-hmm. So I said, oh, so I did them a quarter of an inch. And I said, can you read this? Mm-hmm. Which he could.
Uh-huh.
And stuff. So it was sort of like, that's how I got to a quarter.
Right.
In fact, I have practical reasons for almost everything that I've ever done. Like when I first started the fact paintings, they were all 5 feet by 7 feet. I wanted them large because that defined contemporary art to me was size. Mm-hmm. I had an Econoline van, and that was the largest you could get into the Econoline van. Coincidentally, when I moved into this loft, 5x7 is the biggest I can get down the stairs.
Okay.
And it takes two people
uh-huh.
to do it. And they have to be
flipping
it
over the
over the railing and all this sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's a practical reason.
Right.
So I did those pieces for a number of years. And then I had a bad experience with a dealer who had shown them. Very bad experience. I lost the vision in a second. It was sort of like there on Monday and gone on Tuesday. And it was not only the
because
vision,
of your experience with the dealer?
Yeah.
What happened? Did they just not pay you? Did they?
Yeah, it was your typical story.
Kind of
you
took
know,
advantage of. So work sold and they didn't pay you?
Well, it was a little more complicated okay. than that. Like a standard MO would be, say if a piece was hypothetically $10,000 and the dealer would call up and say, I have a collector for it, but the collector will only pay $6,000. And knowing, of course, that the artist was broke, you know, half of $6,000 is better than half of zero.
Right.
So you would say, yeah, of course. And then I accidentally found out that the painting had sold for $10,000.
Whoa.
So I got three and the dealer got seven.
Whoa.
And this turned out to be a sort of consistent pattern.
With the same dealer.
With the same dealer.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Who will remain unmentioned.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyway, so I pulled all my work out of the gallery.
Mm-hmm.
And in my exit interview, the way I supported myself at the time was that I had a job in the garment industry. I worked 4 days a week at my parents' accessory company.
Oh, wow. Okay.
You know, and when I went to get the last pieces, which she held so that I would have to show up for them,
mm-hmm.
she said to me, the garment industry has made you hard. And I said, looked at her and I said, you make the people I work with in the garment industry look like they're in kindergarten. I mean, it was a huge learning experience for me. And to mentally prepare to deal with this dealer, I would read, any time I had to see her,
mm-hmm.
I would spend a day reading Jerzy Kaczynski, which should tell you.
Yeah.
Which should tell you everything that you need to know.
Wow.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So that experience, when was that? That was
That was in the 70s sometime.
Okay, okay.
In the late 70s.
And
late,
so those
late,
still,
late.
Okay.
He's early 80s.
And so these are the word paintings. Those weren't the,
those
the cow, okay.
No. Those were the word pieces. And
okay.
they took incredible discipline to do.
Mm-hmm.
I would do the drawings. I would do them on a light box. Eventually, I didn't want to draw the grid anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I began to feel it was getting in the way.
Mm-hmm.
So a friend of mine made me a beautiful 4-foot square light box, which I had on a big table. And so I had to teach myself to know what tone I was drawing with the light on. Otherwise, I would be flicking the light on and off constantly, which I did for several months until I did learn. And then I just had to do it like once an hour or so to just check up on myself to see what I was doing. Mm-hmm. I just lost the discipline to do it. Mm-hmm. And I lost it in mid-piece.
Oh.
There was no way I was going to finish the piece.
Okay.
And I knew it. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I think a big thing about being an artist is to really be very honest with yourself, mm-hmm. very brutal mm-hmm. with yourself about what can go, what can't go, what are your parameters, do you have any parameters, should you mm-hmm. have any parameters. Mm-hmm. But you also have to know when you're done with something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it may be in a very unfortunate timing.
Yeah.
But when you're done, you're done.
Right.
That's it.
Right.
Sorry.
So what did you do?
What I did was I did other work.
Okay. So and then did that come right away, or was there a fallow period for you, or what?
I like to work, and uh-huh. because I was also working jobs uh-huh. at the same time, I so treasured my studio time, so I'd just come in here and fool around. Mm-hmm. And we happened to have, at the time that this happened, we had a subscription to Opera Orchestra, Eve Queller's Opera Orchestra. Do you know it?
Mm-mm.
Oh, it's wonderful. I believe it still exists. We subscribed for years and years. The operas are not staged. The orchestra is on the stage, the singers come out, mm-hmm. and they sit, and when it's their turn to sing, they stand up.
Uh-huh.
And so it's like straight from the libretto. Uh-huh. And they have the lights on a little bit in the audience, and your program is the libretto.
Hmm.
So you actually have an opera experience where you know what people are saying, no matter what language they're speaking in. And it was a Verdi opera. I'll have to look it up and get back to you. But there was a mistake in the libretto where they meant to be saying Muslims. They said Musselmans, M-U-S-S-E-L-M-A-N. And I'm like hysterically laughing. I'm cracking up. And Bill, my husband, he's going, pull yourself together. And I'm going back. Look, so what I did is within the week, I took a piece of unstretched canvas, but gessoed, and I tacked it up on the wall, and I did a muscle man, because
uh-huh.
I was a bodybuilder at the time. It's uh-huh. one of the reasons that the pun struck me on so many levels was because I was a very avid and committed bodybuilder.
Wow, really?
Oh, yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, so I did this dog's head.
Uh-huh.
on this muscled body, and I wrote man mm-hmm. all over his body.
Mm-hmm.
And because I was, you know, still thinking about the language that I was convinced I would never use again, which turned out not to be true, but mm-hmm. at the time, who knew?
Mm-hmm.
And I did 3 or 4 of them. And then I did a painting. I did a painting of a dog, just a dog, my uh-huh. dog. And it was big, and it was big. And I liked the painting so much that I decided not to put the words on it. So after that, there were no more words.
Okay.
I mean, that's how I exited language and entered painting. So I did those for a couple of years. And then I was offered a show at PS1.
What year was that?
Who knows? I have to look all
but
these
things
But it
was this body
up.
Of work. It was the Muscle Man.
Yeah, okay. yeah. And it was when Ed Leffingwell was the curator.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't have very much lead time.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a big room. So, you know, that kind of focuses
yeah.
you. I'm
yeah.
actually, I'm very good at responding to that kind of pressure.
Mm-hmm.
Equally as good as just having an interior conversation with myself between my paintings. It mm-hmm. can go on and on and have nothing to do with the outside world.
Mm-hmm.
But if I have a date and I'm working from there backwards, I'm really good.
Mm-hmm.
So I had gotten this book called The Women's Encyclopedia of Myths and Secrets, which somebody had told me about. And it's one of the most wonderful reference books that anybody could have. Because you can look up anything. look up Eve, and it will tell you the story of Eve through every culture. Because our stories, we have a set of like basic stories.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And the names are different. Some of the circumstances are different. But we have a basic set of stories, and it just traces it in sidebars.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, you can go cross-references. So I'm sitting there reading, fascinated over this, and I thought, wow, this is really interesting. And because of what I was reading, it split my image in two. So instead of having an animal-headed figure, which I had by then already researched and I knew a lot about it historically, it goes way back, you know, and this was before internet research was different. It was books that you went to. Anyway, and I had talked to people, and, you know, people are really have always been very generous about, like, helping to educate me when they knew something that I clearly didn't. So at any rate, I split the image in two. And so one half, the figure part, became Greek and Roman statues. And then the animal became the animal. And I was putting them in these incredible, lush landscapes that, of course, could not have possibly existed, except with people who go out there and weed that damn garden every day.
Right.
But I didn't have a garden, so I didn't know any of this stuff. So I just had to put them somewhere, and I liked looking at gardening books. So, you know, I go, oh, great, here's a good garden. Let's use this little section of it and stuff like that. So I did that for some years. And then my husband was doing these sculptures of fighting cowboys, and he had a book. Actually, the book he had been my book, and he had one day just walked in and taken it, and he developed this beautiful, beautiful body of work with it. And I was going, you know, it's a cowboy. It's this feel-good symbol somehow to guys. You know, a cowboy is like a hero.
Right.
To guys and stuff. And I was interested in that. I had no idea what it meant, was the thing. And at the same time, I was interested in putting things together that were from different times in culture. An art historian had come in and seen one of my paintings that had a Greek and Roman statue of something in it, and then a stele from another period. And he had gotten very, very angry at me because I had historically mixed things up.
You did a little mashup, yeah.
Yeah, I did a little mashup, you know? What the hell? Nobody's looking at this stuff. Doesn't everybody do this? In the privacy of their studios. Anyway, so his anger had interested me. I didn't feel defensive about the painting because I didn't have to justify what I was doing to anybody. So, you know, I was just interested in his anger. But I started to think about, well, let's put things together from different periods. So I started looking up cowboys and getting cowboy imagery and putting them together and stuff. So I was doing these paintings with American cowboys and Greek and Roman statuary, and the statues were all women. So it very quickly, and without my intent, became very political. I mean, that was obvious. Even I recognized what I was doing there. And Stefan, and I started to glaze on them as a technique because I did one that had a lot of fire, and there was no way that you could get a subtlety of tone without glazing and a depth of tone. So I got really interested in glazing. I am sort of like a wind-up toy. You know, I'll just start in some direction, and I'll just keep going until I hit that wall. And
were those oil paintings then?
No, they were acrylic.
And you were glazing with acrylic even?
I was glazing with acrylic, and I was glazing dark to light and light to dark. I realized with acrylic you could go either way you wanted. It didn't make any difference. So I was doing the whole paintings just in glazing. I would do a basic underpainting, and then I would just like start in. And I started to have my doubts about the series. Well, I started to wonder if I walked into a gallery and saw these paintings, if I would like them.
Mm.
And that's a very big question.
Yeah.
To start to have a doubt about.
Yeah.
You know? So I decided I wouldn't like these particular.
Mm.
I would wonder what I was thinking if I saw these paintings. So I did a small painting. I found this Roman bronze of a woman in a classic muscle pose. It's the classic.
Mm, okay.
Arm flexed bicep pose.
Uh-huh.
And I said, well, I think I'm going to go out on her. And behind her, I hung the cowboy. I found some photos of lynching. So I took one of them, and that's what the rest of the painting was.
Wow.
And a friend of mine came over and said, I think you're done now. And I said, oh, totally. We have killed the cowboy. Because it was one of those things, like, I wasn't happy with the series, but I didn't have another idea.
Mm-hmm.
And I did have ideas about this one. So I was just sort of like going on and going, how am I going to get out of this? So I killed the cowboy.
Okay.
And once you kill the cowboy, well, you're done with the cowboys. So then I wanted to do things with the figure and not statues. So Toshin had come out with this wonderful series of books. They're really like softcore porn books.
Mm-hmm.
And I started to paint the women, some of the women that I found in them, in landscapes, which were actually my yard in the country, with the mountain view. And, you know, I took tons of photos, and then I sold the house. Where do I go? The photos sort of don't mean anything to you anymore. So I thought, well, this would be good use. And so I was putting them with some of these women, and they're saucy and they're softcore.
Mm-hmm.
And I had previously done on some frying pans and saws some of the art historical statues, also mm-hmm. in landscapes, and every once in a while, like with a bunny,
mm-hmm.
like the, you know, the pan statue where he's fucking the goat.
Oh yeah, yeah, okay,
yeah,
yeah,
right. That's a classic statue. So that's the center, and then off to the side is the bunny.
Uh-huh.
You know, me next. Yeah, uh-huh. And the pieces were very lighthearted,
uh-huh.
serious humor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't particularly think they were funny, but people would laugh
mm-hmm.
when they would look at them. And my cowboys, when women would come up here, they would laugh when they saw them. That was their first reaction, universal.
Mm-hmm.
Men over a certain age cover their balls,
literally. Really?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I thought, I have no idea why. Yeah, I have no idea why they feel so threatened by these.
Wow.
But so I was doing that, and actually I also then did some drawings on half tones of the books. I defolioed the books, and I'd hand tint this whatever skin was showing, and then create this fantasy landscape
mm-hmm.
around it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like totally changing the context and stuff. And that's what got me back to sex.
Mm, okay.
I mean, it was sort of like I realized mm-hmm. I had gone in a total circle.
So were you showing this work, or were these the conversations you were having around the work just friends that were coming by the studio? Or
No, I basically showed almost everything that I did, not prestigiously.
Uh-huh.
You know, mm-hmm. I wasn't represented by any gallery, but there were still, like, alternative galleries,
mm-hmm.
alternative spaces, and I'd be in group shows, or a university would offer me a show in their university gallery,
mm-hmm.
Stuff like that. So I had a very low-level career.
Okay.
Until I showed with Mitchell Algis.
And that was 2002?
That was in 2002.
Okay.
The first show, of course, was old paintings and drawings.
Mm-hmm.
And the second show was the Cao Kun pieces and the first of the new pieces, which were stamp pieces.
Oh.
Okay. I did them with stamps. Uh-huh. Back to the language thing. Uh-huh. I was in the Lyon Biennale after the first show,
wow,
that at which was compliments of Bob Nickus's persuasiveness with the consortium and the other curators who curated the 2003 Lyon Biennale. Mm. And he got me in, and he had proposed and did a room that was half me and half Steve Perino's work. And it's a really brilliant pairing. Mm-hmm. You know, we were so in sync and so conflict in exactly the right ways to make for a great room. Mm. And Steve Perino, he was just like this wonderfully generous artist. You know, when we were all leaving Lyon, we were all at the train station to go wherever we were going. And I said, Steve, do you think that the show will get some good notice? And he said, Betty, we're the best goddamn room in the show. Of course we're going to get good notice. Get ready. And I thought that was so generous because it was inclusive.
Right.
It was inclusive to me.
Right.
And not just him. I thought that was really wonderful. Mm-hmm. So I had wanted to do a little drawing for Bob as to thank him, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm, because here I was walking around Lyon. And in this big international show, two things I thought I would never be doing. Mm-hmm. Bill and I are doing a walking tour in Lyon, and I said to him, I should give Bob a drawing. And he said, what should you do? In one of my totally off-the-cuff remarks, which is how I solve a fair number of my problems, I said, I'm going to get a stamp that says Lyon on it, and I'll do some of the images. And if one of them turns out okay, I'll give it to him. Mm-hmm. We have a place in the country, so in the car going up and back, we started thinking of a vocabulary to have made into stamps that would be like a sex vocabulary. Mm-hmm. But what I had, because I was so excited about the idea, that even though I didn't have the Lyon stamp, I wanted to do the idea, so I go rummaging in my drawers, mm-hmm, and I found two stamps from the 70s. One of them said cow, and the other said censored, because I'd been censored, mm-hmm, in the 70s. Mm-hmm. And so I got cow. That's perfect. What a pejorative. So I did these stamp drawings, and I did seven of them. I still have three, including the first one. And they're very high contrasty, and you could see by the time I was even at the fourth one, I had made the idea very much more complex and volumetric, and I'm like really pushing this idea. So after I did seven, I said, it's time to do a painting. And I am of the type, I don't do sketches. Mm-hmm.
Just dive in.
I just dive in, jump around, sink or swim, mm-hmm, until I figure out what I need. So I started with a 7-foot by 5-foot camp. And I would look at the little stamp. Stamp, and I would look at this big canvas, and I said, it's possible you're insane, because this is even crazier than the word piece. And I got really good at it, and I love working with it, mm-hmm, because the pieces give the appearance of reading without your actually being able to pick out much. Like, if you really stare at it, mm-hmm, you can find each of the words that I would use. Like, I would always have a really long word for a curve, because it turned out if you used itty bitty stamps, it was jumpy and jerky and had no grace,
right,
to it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, where I wanted that grace, mm-hmm, and that volume. So I would always have to have a long word. So beanbag was a good long word. And shtup was one of my favorite. To this day, everybody I know who knows Yiddish or German looks at that and goes, shtup? Am I reading? And I go, shtup. So I did these for 2.5 years. And then I developed tendonitis in both of my arms. Really serious tendonitis. So I'm going to physical therapy. and going out for a torturous hour, and then I'm going home and I'm working. And it gradually did dawn on me that I was never going to get better.
If you kept doing
it. Yeah. So I thought, okay, I have to do something less intense. Let's do finger painting. So I did some with my fingers, and that turned out to be exactly the same irritation.
Oh, in because terms of tendonitis.
Because first of all, I'm tapping on my homemade rubber stamp things, which was a cup with a heavy duty sponge in it that I was soaking with paint. So that I, you know, that's how I did them. So I thought, well, I'm not gonna be able to do this. And in the meantime, I had this stamp painting that I couldn't solve and I couldn't let go. And I had started it under serious circumstances. We had a flood in the building and it was very traumatic. And, you know, I threw out 40 garbage bags full of stuff things like that. And, you know, the whole building, of course, was in chaos because, you know, we're trying to figure out how to deal with this, a building-wide disaster like this. And so I made what I considered some bad decisions in the beginning of the painting. And since every later decision is dependent on the first decisions, I just could never, in my mind, solve the problem. So I kept going back into it and back into it. And finally, somebody who was over here said, you know, I think I've seen 4 versions of this painting on this canvas, and none of them are better than the other. Your first one was the same as this. You can't see it anymore. Let it sit or let it go. So I thought about that. I mean, I was very grateful for the comment. You know, because I think it's the only time in my life that I got so bound up in a piece that I had no distance away from it. That was huge for me. So I stopped working on it. And I was exactly at the same time having dreams about that painting. And that if I were doing it with an airbrush, I thought I could solve it. And the airbrush was what I had originally used. And so I go dig out my old airbrush, and it had sprung all its springs, and it had lost many parts. And airbrushes don't have many parts, you know. And I thought, I could put this together. And I said, treat yourself. And I went down to Pearl Paint, and I bought 2 airbrushes. And I had a compressor, and I started to work with the airbrush. And I did 24 by 24 inch cunt image with it, and my hand said to me, you can daydream about anything you want. I'll take over till you remember.
Wow.
And because it knew
muscle
what to
memory.
Do.
Yeah.
It was total muscle memory. I had done it for so long, and it was the only tool I used when I used it. I didn't use anything else. So I let it, and I got most of the way through that painting before I kicked in. And I said, okay, we're a team now. We can work together. Okay. And my hand said, if you're sure. And what was really very funny about it was that at a certain point, not then, I looked in the box that the airbrush had come in. And it had this little instruction bulletin for you, pamphlet for you. So I'm reading it, and I went, wow, I've been doing it wrong all this time. It was actually giving directions. I don't know that Pache is aware of it, but they're giving directions for a double-action airbrush. And a double-action airbrush, you press down, and it releases air. You pull back, it releases pigment. So they have you working the airbrush with your index finger. I always stuck the airbrush between my index and middle finger and work with my thumb, like this. And by that time, Centre Pompidou had bought Fuck Painting Number 1 for its permanent collection. So I just thought, good enough for Centre Pompidou. Good enough for me. And besides, it's what I knew.
Uh-huh.
So I may be doing it wrong to this day. But it's the way I do it. And that's how I got into this work. And of course, everything is different now than when I started. Mm-hmm. When I started, the only acrylic paint that was on the market was the equivalent to what we call heavy body acrylic paint. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There was no anything.
Right.
And when I found out that they had fluid acrylics and that they had an airbrush medium, and if you put them together, mm-hmm. you didn't spend all your time cleaning out your airbrush because it had gotten clogged up.
Right.
You know, because I had figured out ways in the old days to thin out the paint, you know, with water. I knew what consistency finally to get it at and all this stuff. But I only worked with one airbrush then. And so I was spending a lot of time spraying out, cleaning it out. Uh-huh. And so that's why I got two. Mm-hmm. The other thing is that somewhere along the way of doing all this other work is that I had stopped using black paint. From the tube. Mm-hmm. And
are you mixing your blacks? Or
I mix my blacks. And I had started doing it with my paintings. I had probably fallen over it by accident, you know, black sienna and ultramarine blue makes a beautiful black. Mm-hmm. So, you know, then I got curious what other mm-hmm. combos are there. Especially I got curious when I noticed on the back of the burnt sienna that in California it's considered a carcinogenic paint and that you shouldn't
spray. They have very high standards in California.
Yeah, so I called up Golden. I said, what if you don't live in California? And they said, you have to wear a mask. And they explained to me, because all the earth colors basically have silicas in them, glass.
Uh-huh. Oh, okay. So you're inhaling glass.
Yeah, so it's not a good, it's actually not a good thing to be doing. So I went on to other mixtures and stuff, some of which I really liked, some of which I didn't like, you know, but I, you know, like plow through bunches of different things. And so I always think of my paintings as being full of color because I start out with color, you know, 3, 4, 5 colors to get what I want. And then lately,
so this is normal here, seeing this yellow underpainting. And then
this is sort of new. I did it a few years ago, and then I did a whole group of small ones to figure out how it would work. You know, how does the color underneath affect what how you perceive the color on top?
Even if those colors are just gray and white and black.
Absolutely, right? Yeah. And it does. Like in this painting behind you, which has a red underneath it, you can see it really in the cheeks of the ass, and it really looks like the light is coming through her skin and not being projected on it. Mm-hmm. So it does do different things. It makes a different kind of emotional temperature to the painting. Mm-hmm. I actually think that the cooler colors, the cool yellows, the cool greens, the cool blues, actually sharpen up the focus or make it seem as if the focus is sharper. Mm-hmm. And the warmer colors, the reds and the violets and the purples, somehow they always seem a little softer, mushier to me and stuff. So this is one of the things I'm playing around with now. You know, I like to keep myself challenged. Mm-hmm. I can't work if I'm bored. Mm-hmm. And I have to be working from not a total state of ignorance, but some point of ignorance.
Right.
You know?
To keep it interesting.
Yeah, it just keeps it interesting. I have to be really convinced that I can really screw up this painting and totally fail. Mm-hmm. And actually, when I do, I get hysterically happy. You know, I'm half.
When you fail?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because to solve the failure, because I'm the boss here, right. I win, that's the game,
right?
You know, I win here. Mm-hmm. To solve the failure, I have to invent something new. So that's exciting to me, and that's what keeps me going.
So those flesh-colored ones over there, are those finished?
Yeah.
Okay.
They're new. So they're new. This is, in 2006, I did a little work with color. I did a couple pieces on paper, and I did a couple of paintings, and what I thought to myself was, well, the only idea you seem to have about color is monochromatic color. Okay, and so then I stopped thinking about color for those paintings. And then I know somebody on social media who's a huge Guston fan, and this guy is like, he's a collector of sorts, and he's a huge Guston fan. And he said one day, he said, "Nobody can do pink. It's Guston's color." And I said, "Sending you an email. Can't post them here." And I sent him the two paintings. And his response was like really enthusiastic and positive, and it was okay for me to do pink. So I thought about it, and
So just you and Gustin.
yeah, just me and Guston, actually.
Good company to keep.
Well, I think anybody can use it. Pink
Right.
is, there's so many different kinds of pinks.
Mm-hmm.
Red is the most forgiving color. You can throw anything in it and it's still red. Anyway, I did a couple of small ones, and the way they came about was I shoot my own JPEGs, I'm my own record keeper around here. And every once in a while, I don't color correct something if I don't need it right away. I just take it off the camera. I slug in the information so I know what the painting is, the year, and the dimension and stuff. And there was a small painting that got sold, and the collector's conservator had written to the gallery and say, "We would like a JPEG for our records." So I just said, okay, and without looking at it, without thinking, I just attached it and sent it off. And the conservator got really upset because the color had nothing to do with the painting that he was looking at. And the gallery calls me up, and I said, "Well, the way I remember it is the collector was in and personally chose the painting. He didn't buy it from a JPEG. Am I correct about this?" And everybody's double checking, and because it was like already more than a year, and I'm right. So we re he the collector the gallery reassures the conservator and stuff like that. So I'm looking at the JPEG, and I'm talking to this wonderful guy at the gallery, and I'm going, "I kind of like the JPEG." And he's going, "Me too." And I said, "I just never color corrected this." So I did a painting of it, and I pushed the color a little more. And then I did another one. And it was very interesting. It took me four pieces before I felt I knew anything about doing this. So they were all small. Because these were really, I was kind of, I not only have no memory of having done the first two or what colors I might have used, I also didn't think if I did have a memory that I would use it. And if I had labeled paint, I wouldn't use that. I would do what I do. Now invent the whole problem all over again. It's now a new problem. So it took me four to feel really comfortable about it. And when I did the Fug Show, the Bruce High Quality Foundation University Gallery show. Part of the idea of that show was that some of the works would be ersatz. So they would be my photographs of my paintings that had gotten sold from my studio and therefore had been never seen in public anywhere, which is fine. I love selling the work and I love selling it like that, but I was thinking, well, they deserve an airing, and I've been very interested in the digital printing process for a very long time, and I thought this show was a great excuse to see what I could do with my interest. So one of the pieces that I had blown up, because none of them, what I did is I changed all the sizes, I swung the color, in Photoshop, you swing color one place or another. And I worked with this really great printer, and for this really big one that's there, that's actually a print that I then painted on. So the original painting is 22 by 36, and it's a Grisaille painting, but I had this weird JPEG. And I'm going, "Chad, can you push this a little more?" And he said, "Can you give me an idea?" of where you want it to go. So we're not sending proofs back and forth in the mail over and over. So I said, sure. And I did this little tiny thing. You know, I had my colors mixed up. So I did it. I did a little thing where I, you know, just said, this is this color pure. This is this, 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 this. And when they mix, this is their range. So I sent this to him, and he came up with this. And by the time I got to this one, it was a pleasure. To work on. Mm-hmm. And I'm going, I'm getting it! I'm getting it! And then I did one after that. Mm-hmm. So I feel like that's another avenue for me to explore. So I'm really excited about it. Mm-hmm. And I will do full monochromatic paintings with mm-hmm. other colors too, because it doesn't bother me that they're basically monochromatic. Mm-hmm.
How did you hook up with the Bruce High Quality Foundation? Did they just see your work somewhere with Mitchell Algis or with?
They are a younger generation that somehow seems to know my work, and I don't know how. And they got in touch
with
me.
When was that show? How long ago was that?
It ended October 18th.
Oh, okay, so it's
it was just that's this, what
yeah.
that's the show that I'm
oh,
in
I
this
see.
One in New York Magazine for. Yeah. They came to me. Mm-hmm. I have sort of found that if I go to somebody, mostly they say no.
Okay.
It's sort of almost a guarantee. But if they come to me, it's easier for me to get from point A to point B.
Mm-hmm.
Because they have something in mind. They come to me because they have a proposal.
Right.
And the Bruces had, I call them the Bruces. The Bruces had just rented this space mm-hmm. on East 6th Street. And they asked me to do a show.
Mm-hmm.
And we set the date. And I said yes. And the place was unrenovated. And the walls were this rust color. And I thought the place was enormous. As it turns out, it's only 1,200 square feet.
Okay.
And, you know, so I had no problem, mm-hmm. you know, doing enough work on it. Because I had probably one of the few moments of total panic in my studio when I got the first... My idea was that half the show would be paintings and half the show would be photographs of my paintings. And I was curious about what kind of conversation they could have with each other mm-hmm. and stuff. So as it turned out, when I got the first ones and I put them up on the wall to see what they looked like, the difference was immediately clear. Mm-hmm. When you blow something up, no matter how big a file that JPEG is, you lose a ton of detail.
Mm.
And as it turned out, I like the detail.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sort of addicted to the detail
mm-hmm.
in my paintings, which I didn't realize till that very moment.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is that when it's a gradual tone change, which I love to do with the airbrush,
mm-hmm.
you know, it takes 20 plus coats of paint to get the paint meaty and subtle enough so that I can do
mm-hmm.
it. And so then it becomes a great pleasure
mm-hmm.
for me to do and stuff. But with a digital image, you can't have that at that scale. There's a certain point where the tone breaks
mm-hmm.
and it's pixelated
right.
line
yeah.
and stuff. And I didn't particularly like that either. So I started to paint on them.
Oh, okay.
You know, because the other thing was I didn't want it to make it easy
mm-hmm.
for people to walk in and go real fake, real fake, real
right,
fake.
Right.
I wanted them to have to work a little bit. Therefore, they'd also look at the paintings, because a lot of people will just look at signage
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and they won't look at the paintings.
Mm-hmm.
So they're attracted and repulsed at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So I really wanted people to look. So as it turned out, there was all the works on paper in the show. They were all pure air sets. And one of the pieces on canvas was a pure air set. And then there were four pieces. I call them the semi-air sets because they had the paint on them.
Okay. And did that create a whole new body of work for you? Or is that
Well, I had a lot of ideas about where I wanted to take
Because this is just this year then.
Yeah, obviously. Mm-hmm. It goes into another body of work because I really do want to explore it. But I had all these ideas of combining printed with painted sort of like marking territory, like a dog marks their territory, was actually the idea that I had. The one piece I've done so far is not making me happy. So I'm rethinking the idea, and I'm processing ideas, mm-hmm. is what I'm doing, which I do all the time. Mm-hmm. And I will continue with it in one form or another, because it's very intriguing to me. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the pure air sets, when it works, is its own quality. You wouldn't mistake it for a painting, mm-hmm. next to a painting. Mm-hmm. But by itself.
By itself, you would.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And when I work on them, it makes it even more confusing. Mm-hmm. And I like that too. So I'm sort of moving away from the marking territory idea, and I'm into what this combination can do. And I'll just see. Mm-hmm. One of the things on my mind.
It's one of the things on your mind, yeah. Mm-hmm. So what's next? What's coming up?
Ah, what's coming up next is this mountain of canvases behind you. This is going to be...
Is this a new body, or this is the older one?
This is... I started this series in 2002, and I finished it about 6 weeks ago, a month ago. Yeah. This is Women, Words, Stories, and Phrases.
Okay.
And what had happened was that before the Lyon Biennale, sometime in 2002, and actually right before I did the show with Mitchell, I sent out an email that said I'd like to do another series using language. So that's how the Lyon stamp was so easily in my mind, was because I was working with it, with words already. See, everything is very synergistic.
Right, yeah.
You can tell I spend far too much time alone in my studio and not out in the world. Anyway, what I said was I want to do another series of pieces using language, this time about women. Please send me your words and phrases about women. It can be affectionate, like honey. It can be pejorative, like bitch. It can be slang. It can be in any language. If it's not English, please send me an accurate translation. Because mm-hmm. I think if you call somebody a cunt in Chinese, you should know it before somebody punches you.
Right.
So, which I didn't put in the email, but right. Sincerely, Betty Tompkins. I sent it to my whole email list.
Okay.
Altogether, I got 1,500 unique words and phrases with many, many, many repetitions.
Yeah. Did you catalog those?
Yes, okay. I did. I did. I had to make it alphabetical, and I had to know what the words meant. Mm-hmm. So I did that, and I did a couple of small pieces, wood panels. The first one I did is from a baby photo of me, and all the words begin with B. So the bitch word, mm-hmm. and all its variations mm-hmm. are in there. So I did that, and I did another one, and I did a 36 by 22 inch high cunt painting. And before I did the cunt painting, I did a painting of the Venus de Milo. It's called Slut. I was in a show at the Dolly Museum, which is somewhere in Florida. They did a show where Tao artists deal with the Venus de Milo. Mm-hmm. And I had used the Venus de Milo in one of the cowboy statue paintings. And that series, by the way, is called Western Civ.
Okay.
After our old college course. Anyway, so I had just gotten the catalog. And I'm going through, and I go, she's such a slut. Everybody can have her way with her. So I called it Slut, and then I did this piece. It's pretty high. And then I did this cunt image, and I just got really unhappy with it, you know. And I kept working it, and Bill, my husband, said to me, he said, well, your problem is you're trying to get 100% of the information while only covering 2/3 of the surface, and you're never going to get it. I went, And then I went to Lyon immediately. Mm-hmm. I mean, the sequence was very, very, very tight. So when I came back, I was, you know, Lyon stamp, do 3, falls off, do stamps using Cowan, censor things, get new stamps. And I took my list, and I put it away in my studio in Pennsylvania. I just stuck it under some books, keep it nice and safe. And in 2013, I brought it out. It was exactly where I remembered it. Somebody had, who was visiting, and some art advisors were visiting, and they were talking about Jason Rhodes' work. Mm-hmm. And I said, oh, I actually got some phrases from him from a show that he did that had Legos in it. And they said, oh, we'd love to see it. And I went right to the pile, lifted up three books, and there they were.
Wow.
So I thought I should really actually start to paint these. Mm. So on January 1st, 2013, I did the first one. Mm. A little 4x4 canvas. Mm-hmm. And I thought they should all be these little tiny canvases. And then I realized that most of the words wouldn't fit on a 4x4 canvas. Oh. So I have 4x5, 4x6. Uh-huh. And then there were other things. And so 6x12. You know, so I came to my sizes for it. And I thought, you need a goal for this. Mm-hmm. You have to know when it's done. Because I sent out the email again. I got, because I figured, you know, so much more, many more people now, mm-hmm. you know, and they're in the art world. So I wonder what they'll come up with. Mm-hmm. So I just sent it out again. I just said in 2002, I sent out this email and I repeat the thing. And this time I guaranteed them anonymity. Mm-hmm. You know, so I realized the first time that people were probably more polite than they would have been. Mm-hmm. Not that they were really polite, right. But, you know. but that certain people would feel constrained because of, because I would know who they were. Mm-hmm. So I guaranteed everybody anonymity. Mm-hmm. And what I did, as soon as I got the emails, I put them on a master list. So I actually really don't know who sent me what. Uh-huh. And I don't have the time or the inclination to go back right. over a gazillion emails and say, who sent me that right. one? and I got amazing things. And also, people sent me stories. Hmm. You know, like events, things that had happened, things they had said. Mm-hmm. And it got incredibly interesting to me. So I thought, well, you know, you have to know when you think you might be done, because you could spend the rest of your life right. doing this.
Yeah.
So I set a goal, because goal is good.
Yeah.
And my goal was 1,000, uh-huh. which I set when I was on around 7, 8. So it was like the impossible.
Right.
It was the impossible goal. I didn't set myself a time limit, because I had no idea how the paintings would evolve or how my approach to them would evolve, and also I wasn't giving up doing my work. This was sort of like I only did these in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. I never did them in New York. Mm-hmm. And I only did them in the morning, because I'm not really a great morning person, but this has so much organization involved with it that it was a perfect morning project. Mm-hmm. And also in the winter in my studio in Pennsylvania, the sun rakes across my painting wall for 2 hours every day. Mm-hmm. So those were the times that I could work on it. Mm-hmm. And then the rest of the time, I didn't work on it.
Uh-huh.
And I got a little pushier when I got closer to the edge, of right. course, and stuff, but it, you know, Glenn Furman from Flag Foundation was firmly behind this project from the first he saw of them. And because of him, I really had to think about how I was thinking. What did I want for this project? Because now it was really taking form for me. And, you know, several people asked me if I would lend some for a show. And I did lend to one show, which was at Marion Bosky's, the Sunset and Pussy show. And they hung them in the back. They have, like, back viewing rooms. It's really just, it's not for the public. It's where they, where they do business. But they were never out in space. And people kept asking. And I kept saying, no, it's one piece. And that's when I realized, oh, my God, this is one piece of 1,000 units. Mm-hmm. And I would like it to debut as one piece
right.
as of 1,000 Newtons, and I wanted to debut in New York, and I wanted to debut in a not-for-profit, mm-hmm. because the math is too easy, and as we know, mm-hmm. especially the last 12, 15 months, there are more articles written about the art market than are written about the art. Mm-hmm. I mean, this has become, through writing, such an awareness. And I thought, well, if people start doing the math, they're never going to look at the pieces. Mm-hmm. And this piece is incendiary, actually. I felt more uncomfortable painting some of these little canvases than anything else I have ever done.
That's interesting. Why do you think that is?
Because it's language. Mm-hmm. And we relate really strongly to language. Mm-hmm.
It's less open.
It means something. Mm-hmm. You can look at a painting and, you know, you can talk yourself into any delusion you want. But it's really hard to look at a painting that says, woman, equal sign, system for a cunt, and not know exactly what that person meant. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the paintings. Mm-hmm. There's also another one. It's an army term that was used about Filipino girls who went with GIs. Little brown fucking machine.
Yikes.
Right. So, I mean, it's really hard to have a sense of humor while doing these. Some, I think, are hysterically funny because of the ego this shows. Like, there's one that says, the only way she would be more beautiful is with my dick in her mouth. That's very funny, you know? But I worked on this for almost 3 years of doing the actual painting. And I've dated the piece 2002-2015 because I started the piece with that first email. Uh-huh. You know, gradually it got a little harder to get me upset. Mm-hmm. You know, I sort of like got used to the idea of what I was doing here. But this is an upsetting piece. Mm-hmm. So this show opens on January 20th or 21st at Flag Foundation. Mm-hmm. And it'll be up through the middle of May. Mm-hmm. And it's the 10th floor. And I'm so grateful to Glenn for his support
of the piece. Do you know how they'll be installed?
Yes, I do. As it turned out, what I found out from the Boesky installation was that 4x4 is not a standard that is the same through different canvas companies.
Oh.
And I had started out with three different kinds, three different manufacturers, and they're all slightly off, so you can't do it as a grid. Mm-hmm. And what I came up with my friend Natasha Dombrowski, she came here like about a year ago, year and a half ago. I had about 200 of these, 250, and I had said to her, I've never seen these laid out. I have no idea what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. I'm a little more ignorant than I'd like to be. And she said, I'll help you, because I had a really bad back. I still have a really bad back. Mm. And there was no way I could do the bending of it. So Bill laid out for me like a 25-foot-long piece of paper that's about a little more than 4 feet wide. Mm-hmm. And I had them all piled up at the time I was using that counter. And I would just hand them to her. Mm-hmm. A couple at a time, and I said to her, the definition, if it's slang or if it's not in English, is on the back. Otherwise, it's obvious. And so she got very involved in it, you know, and stuff. And so she starts to talk to herself. Mm-hmm. I'm watching this, and I'm watching her lay them out. Mm-hmm. And she did, like, this cloud conversation. She would say, you desperately need to talk to this word over here. And she would just, like, butt them so they would touch each other. Mm. And she would say, I hate you. You're going to Siberia. Betty, this is Siberia down here. And she would put them over there. And I'm having this great time watching her do it. The only installations I've seen like this, and they relate very, very strongly, are the way Todd Levin often installs shows. Mm. And I think this is really brilliant. And she's never heard of Todd Levin.
Mm-hmm.
She came up with this all on her own. And we photographed everything. And that's the way it's going to be. It's a series of cloud conversations.
Oh, wow.
So there's no grid at all.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the pieces talking to each other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and since I did them in Pennsylvania, I dedicated two short walls to hanging them up. So as I was doing them, and then I would photograph them, and I would bring them back to New York. One pillowcase load in a coat at a time. And they're very sturdy pieces. Hard to harm these. Anyway, so I would play around with it myself. Like, one of the ones says, built for comfort. And we all know what that means.
Mm-hmm.
It's a large woman who's soft.
Mm-hmm.
You know, built for comfort.
Mm-hmm.
Not muscular, not lean,
mm-hmm.
and stuff. And what I put right next to it, so it's a 6 by 12 inch piece, and what I put dropping down off of one side, my first wife, is a conversation. So my goal is to get the pieces to talk to each other.
That sounds great.
I hope it will be. I hope it will be. I learned so much when we did this, because Tosh said to me, what do you think? And I'm looking at, of course, it's only like 25 feet long, and now I'm dealing with about 100 feet, but it's three separate walls. I said, well, I need more verticals. There's sort of a natural tendency, since it's language, to go horizontal, but I need more verticals, and we need to have some larger pieces, 18 by 18 inches, 16 by 18 inches, in there, so it doesn't look like wallpaper ever. It's always can be broken up. But I said, other than that, I think this will work. So Tasha's coming with me for the install. And I'm hoping we can do it.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Like, flag is there any way you can lay these out in advance? No, I don't have your walls.
Right.
There is no way. That I can do
so
it.
So how many days do you think they install?
Well, I figure that they're going to lay out 4-foot-wide paper for me along the walls. And I am budgeting 2 days for us to do it. And we can go into another day. And the install, the show between my piece and the ninth floor, which has a group show. And they're budgeting 2 weeks for the install.
Oh, wow. So you got time.
I think it will work. And what I did is I gave them blanks of the different
sizes. Oh, okay.
So, because they had to figure out a leash security system and stuff, which between us all, we came up with. And I said, you need to time this out. Then you have to multiply it by 100.
Right.
And that's how many man hours this is going to take. So we'll see, but it's good, you know. Like, we're excited. The people at Flag are great to work with, and they're all excited about doing it. And you know, Glenn's excited about doing it. I'm excited about doing it. So it'll happen. So that's the next thing. And then the week before that, I'm in a show called Black Sheep Feminist, which is at Dallas Contemporary.
Oh, great!
It's a show that Allison Gingerus has curated. And it's Joan Semmel, Anita Steckel, Cosi Fanni Tutti, and me, all work from the 70s.
Wow, cool.
Yes.
Sounds great.
And then this summer, I have a show at Gavlak Gallery in L.A., which will be my first L.A. show.
Awesome.
And then in the fall, I'm doing a project room with Marlboro Girl.
Oh, wow. Fantastic.
Yeah.
That's exciting.
I'm very excited.
Just one last question.
Sure.
If you had any advice for artists of any age that feel like they're still emerging or mid-career or whatever, what do you think?
Don't sell out. Don't work for other people. Get yourself a day job.
So, right, you were supporting yourself throughout that whole time. Up until 2002, you were still working with the garment?
I was supporting myself until I was well into my 60s. I have had very, very good years and a couple of very dedicated collectors. And I would just think nothing lasts forever, you know? Bank the money.
Right.
It's a tendency, especially when you're young, you know, if you have a good year, however you define it,
right.
to blow it.
Right.
You know? I mean, you deserve it. You worked hard. Right. All that sort of stuff. You blow it. Mm-hmm. And by the time I had good years, I was already not young. And I know that careers go up, down, up, down, up, down, up, down, up, down. So I saved. Mm-hmm. I saved my money. And I also was very fortunate with some investments and stuff like that. But I didn't stop teaching until about 4 or 5 years ago. I left the garment industry at a certain point and was supporting myself by teaching adjunct. Okay. At one point, I was teaching 7 classes a week at 3 or 4 different schools.
Jeez.
So it's a tough way.
Yeah.
It's a tough way to live. It really is. It was what was available to me. So I did it.
Mm-hmm.
But I also did promise myself that if I ever was in a position to, I would start to wean down on mm-hmm. the teaching. So, you know, I made goals.
Mm-hmm.
If I got X amount of money mm-hmm. in the bank, I would let this class go for 1 semester.
Mm-hmm.
I got this amount of money, mm-hmm. I would no longer teach summer school.
Mm-hmm.
That was huge.
Right.
Not teaching summer school was
wow.
huge.
Yeah.
You know, and so I gradually left.
Mm-hmm. Where were you teaching?
I taught at School of Visual Arts.
Oh, okay.
I taught at LaGuardia Community College, CUNY. I taught at the New School.
Okay.
I taught for several years at NYU in adult education.
Mm-hmm.
I taught at the College of New Rochelle.
Jeez.
I spent a couple of semesters. I taught at Drew University.
Wow.
You know, mm-hmm. but my steady ones were SVA, the New School, LaGuardia.
Mm-hmm.
They were like the main ones.
Mm-hmm.
NYU I did for a number of years, and that was the first one I was able to let go.
Mm-hmm.
So I did. Mm-hmm. My feeling, my advice is find a way to support yourself.
Mm-hmm.
What you have to be true to is the work you're doing in your studio. You mostly will not have, if you're young, the capacity to do is resist the marketplace and the pressure. It's a lot, and that's not your job.
Mm-hmm.
Your job is to make the art.
Mm-hmm.
I was very fortunate to hear this one thing. When I was an undergraduate at Syracuse University, the only visiting artist they had the whole 4 years I was there, which was when I was a senior, was James Rosenquist. And it was when he was just about to show the F-111 painting, which was the huge wraparound painting that he had done. And he said, in his talk, when you're in your studio, it's just the art. When you're out of your studio, it's just the business.
Mm.
And it was the perfect thing for me to hear at exactly the right time. So I left school with this firmly in my mind. Not that anybody was interested in young artists in those days anyway, because they mm-hmm. certainly weren't, particularly if they had breasts. They were definitely not interested in young artists and women artists. But I knew that from the beginning. These were two businesses. They're separate.
Mm-hmm.
So stay true to what you want to do as an artist.
Mm-hmm.
Own it. And don't work for the market. By the time you have a body of work ready that you think the market wants, it has moved on anyway. It's not fashion.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It's art. Give yourself a bigger point of view.
Mm-hmm.
If you're real lucky, and if you really push your talent, and if you do everything the hardest way you can possibly think of to do, you have a good shot of doing something that somebody will fall over. You know, the art world, there's so much luck. It's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
But that's my advice, always.
Great.
And I think that's true of any age.
Mm-hmm.
And I can certainly say it about myself. This has nothing to do with being ambitious. This is being honest and practical. This is the better way to go about it. And don't suck up people now.
Awesome. Thank you so much for
talking with me
today. I really
Thank
appreciate
you.
It.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.